This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 25 years ago this week, the space shuttle Challenger exploded upon liftoff. We'll have memories from a classroom and Cape Canaveral in just a moment. But first, I'm joined in the studio by All Things Considered host Sasha Pfeiffer. Hi there, Sasha.
Hi, Meghna.
What do you got coming up?
A lot of coverage today on these huge anti-government protests in Egypt. These are spurred by a challenge to President Hosni Mubarak's 30-year rule. The military has been deployed to enforce a nighttime curfew. Cell phone and internet connections have been cut off. So we'll have a lot of voices and sounds from Egypt, including an interview with the former U.S. ambassador to Egypt, and also just people on the streets. And then much closer to home, we're going to be talking a bit about Evergreen Solar and about whether that was a deal that ever made economic sense, including the often overlooked fact that Evergreen had been planning to set up shop in Massachusetts even before it got a lot of financial incentives to set up in Devon. So in some sense, the state was bidding against itself.
Hopefully ongoing lessons for future plans that the state might have. WBUR's Sasha Pfeiffer, host of All Things Considered. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I was a space geek growing up. I went to space camp, and I was the kid who started the Astronauts Club at my elementary school. So 25 years ago, when the space shuttle Challenger was set to launch the first teacher into space, it was a big, big deal for me. Part of that was because my fifth grade teacher, Mr. Hart, had also applied to the program and made it pretty far along in the process, too. But at 6'3", NASA informed Mr. Hart that he'd be bumping his head up against the ceiling of the shuttle's cockpit. Instead, NASA picked the petite but charismatic Krista McAuliffe from Framingham, Massachusetts. McAuliffe was a history teacher at Concord High School in New Hampshire. And through the Challenger mission, McAuliffe's classroom would be transported miles above the Earth, and her students would be the millions of children around the world, children like me, who were captivated by the mystery and possibilities of space.
The teacher observer, Krista McAuliffe, has been handed an apple by the closeout crew.
That's why January 28th, 1986, still feels so recent and real to me. Mr. Hart had wheeled in a big TV into the classroom. He'd brought popcorn and soda, and we'd pushed all our desks to the edge of the room and formed a wiggling, wriggling dog pile of fifth graders on the floor. I sat right in the front, right at the foot of the television. I'd memorized the shuttle launch sequence, and so along with Mission Control, I counted down. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7,
6. We have main engine start, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Everybody cheered. But as I said, I was the total space geek, so I remember leaning over to Mr. Hart and saying, "But they still have to go through Max-Q." That's the sound barrier, by the way, after which the shuttle throttles up and powers into Earth orbit.
Engines throttling up, 3 engines now at 104%.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
But of course, Challenger never made it.
1 minute, 15 seconds. Velocity, 2,900 feet per second. Altitude, 9 nautical miles. Downrange distance, 7 nautical miles. Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have no downlink.
Seventy-three seconds after launch, the shuttle was gone. In its place, smoke and debris falling back to Earth. In my classroom, there was silence. No one knew what was going on, but we all knew something had gone horribly wrong. My big, burly fifth grade teacher, Mr. Hart, was crying. That's how I experienced the moment where everything changed for the American space program. WBUR's Bob Oakes saw it too, but not on TV. he was actually there at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. At the time, Bob was a reporter for WEEI Radio before it was a sports station. Bob had a background reporting in New Hampshire, where Krista McAuliffe was a teacher, and though he didn't know McAuliffe, he knew some of her friends and family. And so WEEI sent Bob down to Cape Canaveral to cover the launch, a historic moment for America and a moment of pride for New England.
Well, for days we had mostly been reporting from inside because, remember, the launch had been delayed for quite a few days because of weather problems, because of mechanical malfunctions, because of electrical problems. But at the moment of the launch, we were all outside with friends and family and other reporters watching the launch from the viewing stand outside the building that housed all the reporters.
So, Bob, you were down in Florida at Cape Canaveral, and it was a huge event. It was a huge national and international event to have the first civilian go up into space. So what was it like? Set the scene for us.
There were hundreds of people, hundreds of reporters. It was your typical media circus, but it was all a very happy time because everyone thought, of course, that it was going to be a great and positive story. Inside the building where the networks were housed, there were hundreds of reporters and producers and technicians. And outside on the morning of the launch on these huge grandstands that NASA sets up for viewing, there were hundreds of family and friends, and NASA hangers-on were crowding the stands. And it was a very colorful, joyous occasion. You know, people wear NASA regalia and the NASA patches from many of the launches. And it was very loud. There was a lot of laughing and giggling.
And here comes the flight crew now. Commander Dick Scobie, followed by Mission Specialist G. Russell, Ron McNair, and Pilot Mike Smith, followed by Krista McAuliffe, teacher in space, Ellison Onizuka, and Payload Specialist Greg Jarvis. Big smiles today, confidently getting into the van. They're going to go up to that pad and attempt a second try.
I remember it, in my mind's eye anyway, as being a fairly cloudless morning, a lot of blue sky, but it was very cold, and it had been very cold since early in the morning because it had been cold for like a week, and they delayed the launch that morning because of frost on the fuel tanks. Frost, of course, which later was determined to have played a part in the O-ring failure that caused the explosion.
On the solid rocket boosters. So at that moment when it was clear that something had gone horribly wrong, that major malfunction, as mission controllers were saying, what was it like there on the viewing platform?
It was just confusion and disbelief, not only on the part of the spectators who were there, who were in her family or who were friends, but I think also for a great number of reporters who were not professionals in covering space. No one really knew what to do, and there was very, very little information at that point coming from NASA, because I think for NASA it was an unbelievable moment as well.
Well, you ended up staying there in Florida, obviously much longer than you had initially anticipated. And after that initial confusion, as you were saying, that evening, President Ronald Reagan got on television and actually had one of, you know, what many people believe one of his finest moments as a communicator for what the nation was thinking and feeling at that time.
Well, Ronald Reagan was supposed to be on TV and on radio that night already delivering his State of the Union address, but the address was immediately canceled, and instead Reagan came on and delivered, as you say, what many people thought was perhaps his finest speech ever. It was only 600-plus words, but it was so moving, and it was so incredibly memorable, especially that last line where he said, We'll never forget them,
nor the last time we saw them this morning as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God.
I actually still feel that now. And I remember saying on the radio that night after the speech that the nation is sobbing at this moment for Krista McAuliffe and that crew of seven on the Challenger.
You know, Bob, for people of my generation, until 9/11, Challenger was the moment that I can recall where, as you say, the nation sobbed together. Everyone held their collective breath. And when we figured out what was happening, America was in mourning. For you, what was it like being from Massachusetts, knowing members of the McAuliffe family, having worked in Concord where she was teaching, that like our region was the heart and soul of where all this mourning was taking place?
There was a pall over the entire region for days and days. I spent several days in Florida covering the aftermath of the launch. And I remember the night of the launch, very late at night, when we finally ended our broadcast, I went out to eat dinner with a couple of reporters from New Hampshire. And we went to a restaurant that was absolutely crowded at that moment with NASA workers and other reporters. And you could have heard a fork drop in the restaurant. No one was talking. It was very sad. And when I finally got back to Massachusetts days later and traveled out to Framingham to do stories from where Krista McAuliffe was from, her hometown, and when I went up to Concord, New Hampshire to do stories from the high school, you could still feel the effects. And I think even weeks later, people were still very disbelieving that this event occurred.
So here we are on the 25th anniversary of the Challenger disaster. And it just so happens that the entire shuttle program ends this year as well. When Space Shuttle Atlantis makes its final liftoff in June, there will be nothing to take its place. After 135 missions, NASA has no next-generation space plane. And with the end of the shuttle program, with it goes the largest source of inspiration and wonder for kids who dream of exploring the solar system. There are private space projects in the works, and there's the International Space Station. But to me, it's just not the same. For all the talk of returning to the moon, we didn't. For those who hoped for a manned mission to Mars, it doesn't exist. Krista McAuliffe envisioned a different future, one she shared with PBS in an interview a few months before the Challenger flight. McAuliffe saw her mission as any teacher would, as an opportunity to push her students to expand their horizons.
They've got to get ready for this. Their grandchildren are probably going to be on space stations. They're going to be totally different fields. I mean, there's going to be space law. There's going to be business in space. And students have to prepare for that future. And I think this will help them do that.
Before we go today, I actually want to take another minute to say hello and welcome to Anthony Brooks, who joins me for just a moment in the studio right now. Hey there, Anthony.
Hey, Magna. Nice place you got here.
Try to keep it spiffy, you know. As many of our listeners have already been hearing, starting on Monday, Anthony will be joining me as co-host of Radio Boston. And all of us at Radio Boston are so, so pleased to have you. It will be absolutely great for our show and great for our listeners. So, Anthony, a gigantic welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, Magna, thank you very, very much. I really appreciate that. And I'm very much looking forward to this.
Okay, so if I think back, you've been reporting for WBR and NPR for
well, let's just say for quite a while, since well before the Red Sox were known as World Series champions anyway.
Before 1918?
Not that far back. But certainly when I started, the Southeast Expressway was still elevated and still jammed, and the big dig was something the mob was doing to hide the bodies. In any event, As I said, I'm thrilled to be here. You've already been doing terrific work, Magna, on Radio Boston. I mean that. And I really look forward to working with you and producing more great stories about our city and region. It's going to be a lot of fun.
It's going to be a ton of fun. And let's give people a little bit of a preview on what you've been working on that we're going to hear next week.
Okay. Well, one thing. I just did an interview today with a guy named Bobby Martini, who has written a book about his experience growing up in the early 1960s in Somerville, which happens to be where I live. That's when a bloody gang war broke out between two powerful Irish mob families in the Winter Hill neighborhood. Bobby lived through it. He was part of it. He knew the wise guys. He lived the code and paid some tough prices. And his book tells quite a story about Boston's pre-Whitey Bulger history.
That sounds really fascinating. I just want to give people a little glimpse of another thing that we'll be doing. There's a new blood test for Down syndrome. This one will allow pregnant women to take a simple blood test to determine whether or not they're carrying a child who has Down syndrome earlier in pregnancy than ever before. So lots of ethical questions there. Well, that's all coming up next week on Radio Boston. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com. Our show is produced by Adam Ragusea, Jessica Alpert, Dan Mazzi, and Rachel Gottbaum. Our interns are Jason Breslow and Amory Siverton.
Jeremy Bernfeld is our web producer. Tim Skoog, our technical director. The executive producer of Radio Boston is Mark Navin.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend and join both of us Monday for more Radio Boston.